Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. When Attorney General William Barr said this in a speech in December, when he made this threat, he was clearly talking about communities of color in the United States who dare to protest what they see as police brutality. But today, it's fair to wonder if there's at least a part of him that thinks this respect for law enforcement that he demands in this clip might even apply in his mind beyond a certain point to President Trump.
Today, American people have to focus on something else, which is the sacrifice and the service that is given by our law enforcement officers. And they have to start showing more than they do the respect and support that law enforcement deserves. And if communities don't give that support and respect, they may find themselves without the police protection they need.
If communities don't give respect to law enforcement, they might find themselves without the police protection they need. Chilling. But that was Barr in December, and we know he thinks in general that poor black and brown people are too hard on law enforcement, and law enforcement has been too hard on President Trump, in Barr's view. But even Barr may have his limits. Last night, the Washington Post reported that a person familiar with Barr's thinking said he's considering resigning as Attorney General because President Trump keeps tweeting and saying things about specific criminal cases. The Justice Department says Barr has no plans to resign, but that kind of language doesn't rule anything out. According to the New York Times today, Barr was especially irritated by the president's tweet yesterday denigrating Judge Amy Berman Jackson shortly before she was to hold a conference call with lawyers in the Roger Stone case. Trump insisted in his tweet that Judge Jackson order a new trial for Stone, but the Justice Department then disclosed that it opposes a retrial. And the Times says that opposition was personally approved by Attorney General Barr. In fact, it got a little lost last week. I'm going to play another clip. When Barr said on ABC that Trump's tweets make it impossible to do his job, right? And everyone was speculating that Trump and Barr coordinated that. So if Trump is a little quieter, Barr can keep having his back, even if that's stretching the limits of the rule of law. But it got a little lost that Barr also said there that he supports Roger Stone's conviction per se.
Well, as you know, the Stone case was prosecuted while I was Attorney General, and I supported it. I think it was established he was convicted of obstructing Congress and witness tampering, and I thought that was a righteous prosecution. I was happy that he was convicted.
The Attorney General on ABC last week. So we now officially have the President and the Attorney General speaking publicly on different sides of the Roger Stone obstruction of Congress and witness tampering conviction, and the Washington Post report saying Barr is thinking about resigning. Does this mean Trump will stop interfering in specific cases? Well, here's the President yesterday reacting to Barr.
The Attorney General is a man with incredible integrity. Now, just so you understand, I chose not to be involved. I'm allowed to be totally involved. I'm actually, I guess, the chief law enforcement officer of the country, but I've chosen not to be involved. But he is a man of great integrity. But I could be involved if I wanted to be.
Could be involved if I wanted to be. And as if to make the point, the president gave pardons or commuted the sentences of 11 different people yesterday. You've heard this in the news, Bernie Kerik, Rod Blagojevich, and all the others, almost all of them convicted of some kind of corruption, taking or offering or soliciting bribes. Remember how he said he wanted Ukraine to investigate the Bidens because he cares about corruption. Law enforcement is too tough on people in this country who are actually convicted of corrupt acts, apparently. But again, to quote William Barr, people have to start showing more than they do the respect and support that law enforcement deserves. If communities don't give that support and respect, they might find themselves without the police protection they need, what he said in December. So maybe that even applies to the president and the protection that Barr has been providing to him by policing the rest of the Justice Department on Trump's behalf. And there is so much more to this story that we haven't even touched on yet. The adventures of President Trump and the rule of law and the rule of law response just over the last few days. With me now is Quinta Jurecic, managing editor of the website Lawfare, which covers national security and the law. Hi, Quinta. So many moving parts. Thank you for coming on today to try to lend some clarity.
Thanks for having me.
How unusual is it for the president to say, as Trump did yesterday in that tweet that Barr reportedly objected to, that a specific judge should grant a convicted person a new trial, as Trump tweeted in the case of his friend Roger Stone?
Well, it depends how you frame the question. I would say for Trump specifically, it's not unusual at all. We've seen these attacks on judges many times over the course of his presidency, and including his attacks on a Mexican-American judge very early on who he felt had ruled against him in a private case. That said, for presidents generally, before Trump, this would have been absolutely shocking and absolutely beyond the pale. It's really not the kind of thing that presidents do. And you can see how rare it is in that a Judges Association of Federal Judges actually announced that they would be holding a meeting impartially in response to those statements by the president because they were so alarmed.
You want to talk about that? That's another of the pieces that is one of the moving parts that I was referring to at the end of the introduction, but that I didn't include in the introduction. Tell us more about that meeting and what this Association of Federal Judges is. I believe that emergency meeting, as they're calling it, is scheduled for today.
That's correct. So this is a group of federal judges. They're holding an emergency meeting. It's an independent, voluntary organization of judges. They put out a statement saying that they could not wait until their scheduled April conference to describe to discuss a deepening crisis regarding the Justice Department, which I think really speaks to the level of alarm that's happening.
And let's describe this group a little bit. As I understand it from what I've read, this is all 1,100 or so federal judges who have lifetime appointments. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
I mean, that's an amazing definition of a group of people, right? Which trade association do you want to belong to? How about the one that includes 1,100 federal judges who have lifetime appointments? And so these are presumably people who are beyond politics at this point, and they're defining an emergency.
That's right. And I think it also recalls statements also by Chief Justice John Roberts, who, if you recall, put out a statement in the last year or so, basically responding implicitly to attacks by the president on the independence of the judiciary, essentially saying that, you know, the judiciary is independent, that it won't yield to these kind of attacks. Again, not discussing the president directly, but it was kind of an implicit rebuke. And I think you see in that how the judges are really in a difficult position here because they can't respond directly to these kinds of statements by the president because the power of the judiciary is precisely in how it is understood to be impartial and above politics. And so engaging with attacks by the president in this way risks making the judiciary appear like it's sort of getting drawn into partisan mudslinging. On the other hand, if the judiciary doesn't say anything, then you're kind of letting the president's statements go unchallenged. So it will be interesting to see what, if anything, comes out of this emergency meeting.
Do you happen to be familiar with the head of that judges organization? I don't have her name in front of me, but I understand she's a George W. Bush appointee. And is she the one who called this emergency meeting?
I'm actually not sure if it was called by the leader, if it was a collective decision. But either way, it's clearly whoever called the decision, it is an extraordinary thing to do.
I do understand that the leader is George W. Bush appointee, though most of the executive committee under her was appointed by our judges who were appointed by Clinton and Obama. The issue the president is keying on in the Stone case is the revelation that the forewoman of the jury identified herself publicly just the other day as unhappy with Trump's interference in the case, and then a search of her social media turned up previous anti-Trump comments and a fist bump and other celebratory emojis when she and her fellow jurors convicted Stone. Do you, as a legal analyst, have an opinion about whether that becomes bias in a way that could lead to a new trial?
I think the thing that's important to understand here is that the way that juries are selected. So it's certain, it's not the case that, you know, the judge basically picks the jurors and there's nothing that Roger Stone could have done about it. In fact, we have the transcripts available from the jury selection, and it appears that Stone's lawyer asked multiple questions of this juror, that her political affiliation, the fact that she had previously run for office as a Democratic candidate, was discussed. And in the end, Stone's lawyer did not ask the judge to remove her from the jury pool, and the judge didn't take action either. So with that in mind, I would say it's a little rich for Stone and his supporters now to kind of be suggesting that this juror's, you know, background political affiliation somehow biased the trial against him. I would also say there are a lot of excellent defense lawyers who have been commenting on this, saying that the standard for getting a new trial because of some kind of bias on the part of a juror is very high. And so this may seem like a sort of potentially interesting peg for Stone to hang his hat on, but the odds are very low that the judge will buy it.
And what do you make of Barr kind of drawing the line on this, or at least being irritated by Trump commenting on that in particular, if the New York Times story this morning is right, that that particularly irritated Barr yesterday when Trump tweeted against Judge Jackson on that point? The reputation that Barr is getting is that he's somebody who genuinely believes that the Mueller investigation and these other cases against Trump, investigations in the New York U.S. Attorney's Office and other places, are excessive, that there are too many of them, they're too political in too many cases, they're putting too much pressure on Trump for not enough good reasons. I think Barr genuinely believes that from everything we see as a general principle. And yet, in one of these cases, this Roger Stone case, which has to do with, a Mueller prosecution of somebody in Trump world, in this kind of general bailiwick, Barr seems to think Trump is going too far. What does this all tell you about where the line is for William Barr?
It's a fascinating dynamic between Barr and the president. What it suggests to me is that, as you say, Barr has given every indication that he really does believe that the president has been unjustly persecuted in the past, and that part of Barr's role is, in a way, to protect him, which, it's worth emphasizing, is not the usual way that the role of attorney general has been understood. The attorney general is the attorney for the United States, not for the president. But we've seen in how Barr has, for example, commented on the release of the Inspector General report on the Russia investigation, suggesting that there was political bias against the president, even when that's not what the Inspector General said. The way that he's pursued sort of spin-off investigations of the investigation with the idea that there is political bias, that he really does seem to understand his role as linked closely to Trump's interests. And yet, when the president tweets in this way, he bridles. He gave an interview suggesting that you know, this was untenable, that he couldn't do his job if the president continued tweeting. And then, of course, the president continued tweeting because that's what he does. And Barr seems very unhappy. What it suggests to me, and I want to be, you know, careful about not speculating too much about things that haven't been publicly reported, is that perhaps Barr really does understand himself to be protecting the president, but he also understands the importance of maintaining some level of institutional legitimacy on the part of the Justice Department. And what that means is also maintaining keeping the level of outrage within the department from the line prosecutors, attorneys, people who work in the department from getting too high. And if the president, you know, routinely tweets denigrating the department's work, undercutting it, pushing Barr to do things like withdraw the sentencing recommendation in the Roger Stone case and substitute it with a much lighter recommendation, which led to those four prosecutors on the case to resign, that's going to lead to a lot of discontent within the department. And so Barr may find himself balancing keeping the president happy, which he seems to see as his role, with preventing a mutiny from within the department.
Listeners, we could take a few phone calls if you have questions or comments for Quinta Jurecic, managing editor of the website Lawfare, as we talk about this whole collection of things just in the last few days that pertain to President Trump and the Justice Department and the rule of law and the Roger Stone case and William Barr. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Can we pull back from all the details for a minute? It's so easy to get lost in them, and this one thing or another that might be intriguing or that might outrage people on one side or another of politics. What do you think is really at stake here?
At risk of sounding like I'm exaggerating, I think what is really in question here is the rule of law in the United States. And what I mean by that is it has long been a foundational principle of our democracy that law enforcement should be separate from political interference, and that is part of the reassurance that we have that, you know, the president isn't going to go after, prosecute a particular individual just because he doesn't like them, say, or that people who are friends with the president will be treated equally. And that's what we mean when we describe equal justice under law. What I think we see in Trump's approach to the Justice Department, which largely Barr has assisted in making reality, as a vision of the presidency that, as my colleague Benjamin Wittes would say, is about advantaging friends and disadvantaging enemies. It's a vision of law that is all about the will of the person in power, in this case, Trump. And that's really antithetical to what we would have previously understood as really the underlying structure of democracy and the rule of law.
There are many Republicans saying President Obama criticized judges. He criticized a Supreme Court decision in his State of the Union address one year, and that was not the only example. So if there's a consistent standard here, did both Trump and Obama violate it, in your opinion, if to different degrees?
I think it's important to draw a distinction between criticizing the Supreme Court versus attacking an individual judge by name, which is what Trump did in that case, in the Stone case. That said, it's absolutely true that sometimes these lines are fuzzy. A lot of what governs the behavior of the president, as we've all learned over the last couple of years, is norms, is how we think the president should behave rather than any hard and fast rule. And what that means is that sometimes presidents step over the line. So what I would say is that if a person believes that, for example, it was stepping over the line for President Obama to criticize the Supreme Court for Citizens United in his State of the Union, that may be the case. But naming a particular judge is way, way farther over that line. And it's also the case that that's one example of Obama behaving in that way versus President Trump, who has just repeatedly engaged in these campaigns against the independent judiciary. Almost every time that a ruling comes down against him, he's criticized the lower courts extensively for the travel ban, for rulings against the wall he wants to build on the southern border. And so while there may have been conduct by previous presidents that kind of straddles the line, maybe steps over it, President Trump is way, way on the other side of that line.
Let's take a phone call. Justin, you're on the air with Quinta Jurassic from Lawfare. Hi, Justin.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning to you again. I just want to ask, as a black man in America, I realize that the justice system is not about right or wrong. It's about what the white and the powerful agrees and disagree with. And just to ask a question about the jury selection in Stone's case, do you guys think it's deliberate that they would not say anything about a jury that's run as a Democrat, run for office as a Democrat, and they would ignore that so that they can use it as a shield, like at this point after he's convicted?
You mean after he's convicted to be able to say even a Democrat, somebody who is a Democratic Party politician, ran for Congress as a Democrat, I'm not sure how. Explain it a little more, Justin, because how would that work?
I'm saying that for him to get a new trial, could that be a pre-tactics, a deliberate tactic?
I gotcha. So it's the defense, and forgive me, I'm going to move on for time, but Justin, interesting point. Could it be a defense strategy, is what he's asking, to seat a former Democratic congressional candidate if they think she's going to be fair enough, because it helps make the defense's case if he gets acquitted or pardoned?
Well, I'm going to go with the old axiom here that you should never ascribe to malevolence what might just be due to incompetence. It's impossible to say for sure, but that's my sense, is that this may just have been an instance in which, for whatever reason, Stone's lawyer didn't think of this at the time, didn't feel like it was a problem, and it's now being seized on. I will say that the caller makes an excellent point, that part of what we're seeing here is a level of solicitude toward Stone as a defendant from Bill Barr that the attorney general just doesn't seem to give to most criminal defendants, including, you know, an enormous amount of poor people, people of color who go through the criminal justice system every day and, you know, don't have the opportunity to raise questions like, I think this juror was biased against me, you know, because of where I'm from, because I'm black, because of whatever. And so we really do see a kind of a double-tiered system arising that is very disturbing.
Bob, you're on with Quinta Jurassic from Lawfare. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how you doing, Brian?
Okay. Which question?
My question is, does your speaker feel as though the American people will finally realize that when you elect a president of the United States, he has amazing power, and that the American people need to be more discriminating as voters, and we're getting exactly what the people of America wanted by voting this Trump into presidency?
Well, the people who voted for Trump are getting what they wanted, or they won't vote for Trump again later in the year. But Quinta, I don't know if you have any other response to the caller specifically, but he also mentioned to our screener that with respect to presidential power, isn't it true that the president has all the powers that Trump is ascribing to himself?
That's a great point. Yeah, it absolutely is true that as Trump said, the president, under many legal theories, is technically the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. And he does have the constitutional power to interfere in an individual trial. That's separate, though, from whether he should. And I would point to the oath the president swears to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, and his obligation to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, as limitations on his ability to kind of reach down and meddle with an individual trial. It is true, though, that the Trump presidency has really, I think, made clear to a lot of people just how powerful the president is, and also just how important it is that we have a president who understands the importance of not pushing to the edge of his power in every moment.
Judge Jackson is scheduled to sentence Roger Stone tomorrow, though the sentence will be held off on, I understand, until his appeals process is done. What kind of position do you think Judge Jackson is in now, not just with Trump's tweet yesterday calling for a new trial, but with what he and Barr previously agreed on, which was pulling back the 7 to 9 year prison sentence recommendation to not ask for that much?
The judge is in an extraordinarily difficult position here, as you suggest. I do think it's worth emphasizing that this is not a new position for her. She, by the luck of the draw, she happens to be the judge in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia who's handled the lion's share of the cases arising out of the Mueller investigation. So she's probably used to this level of scrutiny at this point. She does have the power, if she wants, to demand that the Justice Department provide more of an explanation for why it changed its recommendation, why the prosecutor resigned. I think it's an open question whether she'll decide to go that route. Again, she has this difficult line to walk between doing justice in Stone's case impartially and pushing back against the oddities of the Justice Department's conduct here, the president's comments. I think everything we've seen from Judge Jackson so far suggests that she's pretty even-keeled, not someone who's going to kind of fly off the handle and make a big dramatic statement, but we'll see.
A friend of mine was speculating to me last night that if she wants to make it harder for Trump to pardon Stone, that she should go with the 3 to 4 years that Barr and Trump seem to think was more appropriate in this case, rather than the 7 to 9 years of the original recommendation from the Justice Department professionals. That if she goes for something in that lower range, then it becomes more politically difficult for Trump to just wave his hand and dismiss the whole case with a pardon. Do you have any opinion about that?
It's certainly true that people have speculated that the president may be kind of setting himself up to grant a pardon to Stone by saying the prosecution was very unfair, the Justice Department recommended far too much time, that kind of thing. As to whether the judge will consider that something that's appropriate for her to weigh in the sentence that she hands down, my guess would be probably not. But again, who knows? The other point I would make is that it may well be the case that it would be more politically powerful for the president to bestow a pardon if the sentence is particularly long. That said, President Trump has never really been constrained by facts, shall we say. And so I would think it might as well be just as likely if Roger Stone gets, 3 to 4 years, that the president would still show up and say, you know what, this is terribly unfair. It's a miscarriage of justice. It's a witch hunt. And I'm going to give a pardon to my friend Roger.
And Trump's 11 pardons and sentence commutations yesterday, without going down the list, how much do you see them as a group as another public message to pressure the judge into a relatively lighter sentence for Stone? Because so many of these pardons and offers of clemency are specifically to make the point that official corruption gets prison sentences that are too long.
It's an interesting question whether the president is making a coherent statement in granting those pardons for, as you say, white-collar corruption issues, or whether it's, you know, he's acting case by case because someone suggested this to him. He saw it on Fox News. It's kind of a emotive expression of his power for him that is just, you know, it's fun to do, right? It's a power that he has that actually can't be constrained by anyone else in a way that a lot of his powers aren't, that the president has the sole power to grant pardons. And there is really nothing that Congress or the courts can do. And so I've always wondered whether the sort of pardon granting sprees that he's gone on have been a way of acting out, perhaps, when he's felt constrained in other spaces and kind of channeling that energy. That said, it absolutely does seem like there is a message that one can read in the pardons that he chose to grant, as you say, in corruption issues, suggesting that people who behave in ways that are reminiscent of folks who have been sentenced in the Mueller investigation might be granted a pardon. And we've seen in the Mueller report conclusions by the special counsel's office that the president did kind of dangle pardons to people swept up in the investigation as something that he might be willing to give them. So while I don't think we know for sure what's happening with that string of pardons, it's certainly worth holding in one's mind and considering the Stone case.
Were there any of the pardons that especially interested you?
I think the pardon of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich was extremely striking for a number of reasons. As listeners may remember, Blagojevich was convicted for trying to sell President Obama's Senate seat after President Obama was elected to the presidency. That struck me for a couple reasons. As I said, I think there is a kind of emotive component to these pardons. And in this case, the commutation of Blagojevich's sentence was in a way kind of a message to Obama, right? Saying perhaps, you know, I still have you in mind. I'm going to pardon this person who was connected to an ugly moment in your political career. It's also notable that Blagojevich was prosecuted by Pat Fitzgerald, who is a friend of Jim Comey and currently Comey's lawyer. So there might be a little bit of a kind of a screw you there as well. The other component is that, again, it seems like the president often pardons people who have committed crimes that he has been accused of, in this case, corruption, trying to get money that perhaps wasn't Blagojevich's to get. And so there may be a little bit of a statement in granting those pardons that Trump himself is beyond the reach of the law in a kind of symbolic way.
Quinta Jurecic is managing editor of Lawfare, a website that focuses on national security and the law. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.